Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you, Thomas, for organizing such an interesting colloquium. I think you'll see a lot of the themes we've been seeing throughout all of these talks again coming to play in plants, which is really exciting. So, as with most of you, I'm really interested in size and shape and how do organisms get their size and shape, which is critical for their function. And, you know, there's very different sizes and shapes of different organisms. If we think about plants, we've got Wolfia, one of the smallest flowering plants here on the tip of a finger, versus the giant sequoia tree. I'm even more interested in organ sizes and shapes, since you can think about the liver is a really cool organ that scales to the size of the body. Or there's the floral organs, which are super important in their size and shape for attracting pollinators. And then cell size and shape is also highly diverse. The classic example is the different size of eggs versus sperm, but we also have all these different hair cells on this sepal. So like the star-shaped ones versus the short green pointy ones versus the real long purple ones. Size is the material that evolution largely works on, but the field's really in the dark. And so if you think about closely related species, often they change size. Here's Arabidopsis thaliana, which is a flower that I'll be talking about today, versus Arabidopsis lyrata, and you can see the big difference is the size. The petals get a lot bigger, but it's got the same parts in it. So to me as a geneticist, this is encouraging though, because it tells me that it has to be genetically tractable somewhere. And for plants, size is super important in terms of thinking about yield, because if you want to improve yield, you're really managing size. But you may have to manage size in a very complex manner. It's not simply making everything bigger. So naively, I was like, yeah, let's make everything bigger. No. Actually, you need to make the whole plant smaller and put bigger grains on it so that you get more grain in the smaller area. And that's really what the Green Revolution did. So if you look at these wheat plants, these are Green Revolution wheat plants. So you can see the plant is smaller and has much larger grains on it. And this was the original, which a larger plant and smaller grains. So we really need to understand this. We can breed for better sizes and shapes of wheat and things. But if we understand it, I think we'll be able to do a lot better. And so what I really love to do is watch the plant as it's growing and developing. And so my lab likes to stick living plants or parts of plants on the confocal microscope and put fluorescent markers in them and image them and watch what's happening. And so what you're seeing here is a developing flower bud. We've got our living plant on the microscope here. This one's been imaged every 6 hours. And so this is your developing floral bud, and you can see all of the cells and their nuclei and what they're doing. And it's quite complicated, right? And then we like to do image processing to track each cell and each of its daughter cells and see what's going on. So this is done in Morphographics, image analysis software created by Richard Smith and his group. And you can see that each cell, maybe we can play that again. Each cell and each of its daughter cells gets the same color. So we've got one red cell here that makes this huge giant cell, and we had one green cell that made this whole patch of green cells. So we're coming back to this question of how are the cells combining their activities to create the organ shape. And part of the reason I think this is such a hard question that we're all grappling with so much is that in a lot of ways it's an emergent process. And this is a theme that we've been thinking about, is that emergence occurs when the whole is more than the sum of its parts, and you can't easily predict from the part what's going on at the whole. I like to show a snowflake because I'm coming to you from Ithaca where there's plenty of snow. And the snowflakes are just a beautiful example of this. So you've got all these water molecules with no blueprint, no DNA, no nothing, interacting just based on their local environment, right? It's interacting with the next water molecule. It's interacting based on the environment it's around. And it makes this absolutely amazing snowflake with all these beautiful symmetry. And the water molecule down here has no idea what's going on everywhere else. So how does this happen? So I think the cells are fortunately have a lot more information. But that's a lot of what we're thinking about, is how are these cells interacting with their neighbors and their local environment to give rise to the organ with properties that are not necessarily there at the cell level. So there's two major questions my lab's really interested in. The first are, how are organs made with reproducible size and shape despite variability at the cellular scale in their growth and division and you name it? And that's what I'll be talking about today. And then the second is how are cells with different sizes? So like the two flip sides of the same coin, like how do you get cell variability and how do you get robustness at the organ scale? Robustness. I'm thinking about reproducibility in terms of robustness. Reproducibility when you're dealing with differences at the cellular level or in the environment. And stochasticity coming in, or randomness coming in a lot into the cellular scale. And we study this in Arabidopsis, even though these are common themes that we've all been talking about. We study this in Arabidopsis, and one of the reasons we like Arabidopsis is that it makes approximately 100 flowers on one plant. So we can look at reproducibility of the sepals, which are these outermost green leaf-like floral organs, in one plant, because we've got four sepals in each flower, about 100 flowers on the plant. We can get statistics on a single plant of how reproducible they are. And if you look across a bunch of flowers, you'll see the flowers are all the same size and shape. The sepals are all the same size and shape. All four sepals on the flower are the same. Sepals across flowers are the same. And you never see something like this with big and small sepals in the same flower. Same, this, again, fundamental question. You've got your little cute mice here with their same size ears, and you never get one with a giant ear. So how is this reproducibility happening? This is also important agriculturally. So look at our red and our blue broccoli head. Now, how many of you would buy the one in red? Okay, not one of you. How many of you are going to buy the one in blue? Okay, we've got more. And then we've got a lot of broccoli haters out there. Okay, yeah. I would buy the one in blue, and the one in red is just going to sit in the store and not be bought. And actually, the store won't even buy it from the farmer because they're like, no one is going to buy this one. And the problem with it is it's got its lack of robustness, right? It's got big and small flowers, which is what your broccoli head is composed of, all in the same head. And this one is robust, so that's the one you're going to buy. We've been having a ton of fun doing outreach during the pandemic, doing outreach to middle school age girls online over Zoom. And we've been taking broccoli and cauliflower and staining it and then imaging it on the confocal microscope and letting them like see how we image this and see what their broccoli and cauliflower are made out of cells. You guys know what cauliflower actually is, what part of the plant that is? No. It's the meristem. It's the growing tip of the plant. So you're eating tons of meristem. Okay, so coming back to the point, as a geneticist at heart, I'm like, okay, if I want to know how you make flowers with the organs of all of the same size and shape, I've got to disrupt this process. And so I'm looking for mutants of variable organ size and shape. We call these the VOS mutants. And here's three of them. This was done by my former postdoc, Dr. Leland Hong. And I'm going to tell you about VOS3 today, so variable organ size and shape D3, and it has another name, AS2-6D, and I'm going to try to use this AS2-6D name consistently. And this is the work of my current postdoc, Dr. Avalish Singh Yadav. And so what's cool about this AS2-6D mutant is that the sepals are covered in all these lumps and ridges. So sepals are supposed to be very, very smooth organs. Their job is to enclose and protect that flower bud while it's developing and keep the reproductive organs safe, right? Like, we do not want any insects or any environment in there. And you can see all of these lumps and folds and ridges on those sepals. Here's a better view. You can see this very smooth sepal surface in wild type, and you can see in the AS2-6D mutant, we've got a bunch of things going on. We've got a bunch of folds or ridges here, and then we've got these outgrowth things that I'm showing you in the red arrows. And so I'll be distinguishing between ridges or folds and outgrowths. Okay, so we wanted to know how this happens. So Avalish did some live imaging to look at this. And we've got wild type over here. You can see it starts out smooth. AS2 also starts out smooth. It's still smooth at day two, relatively smooth. And then at day three, you suddenly see here's one of these ridges forming and two folds on the sides. And so it's starting to make its complex shape right here. And at day four, you can see it's getting more complicated. We've got little indentations within the grooves. And so it's getting much more complicated, whereas wild type stays pretty flat. And so you can see this wildly complex shape. And then it's also got these outgrowths down here. So it's got the ridges and folds and the outgrowths. And so it starts out flat and then gets this complex structure. We asked, is this complex structure only on the outside or is it on the inside? So here you can see the outside of a wild-type sepal is smooth. The outside of this AS2-6D sepal has got this highly complex structure here. But the inside of both is fairly smooth. So here's wild-type smooth structure, AS2-6D smooth inside. So the outside is the one with the problem. So then, of course, we clone the gene, figure out what it is, and it's a mutation in the promoter of a transcription factor, asymmetric leaves 2. And so asymmetric leaves 2 is a known transcription factor. It's involved in making symmetric leaves. This is not going to be a molecular talk. We're not going that direction. We're going toward growth. But what I want you to know is what's wrong with this mutant. What's wrong with this mutant is that this promoter here, this mutation in the promoter, causes too much AS2 expression. So in wild type, you have AS2 only on the inside of the sepal and not on the outside. And then in this mutant, it disrupts a binding site for another transcription factor, and then you get AS2 on both sides. So it's a gain of function mutant, it's a dominant mutant. So this is not loss of activity, it's gain of activity. And we can test that and verify that, and we can see, okay, so we're looking at our flower here, and we've a very young developing flower, and we're taking a longitudinal section through it. So we've got a sepal here, a sepal here, here's the inside, here's the outside, and you can see here in the wild type, with the wild type promoter, you have AS2 only on the inside, this faint green. And then here in the mutant promoter, this is the mutant promoter driving GFP, you can see it's on the outside and also the inside. The inside's pretty weak. So it's a gain of function. And just ectopically expressing AS2, so if we make a transgenic plant where we put AS2 on the outer epidermis, we get the same phenotype back with lumps and folds like we have in the mutant, the original mutant allele. So that's really telling us it's ectopic expression of AS2. But as I said, that's, you know, vaguely interesting. AS2 is doing something here. What is really happening to the growth? What's going on with the growth that creates the lumps and folds? And what happens normally in wild type to keep that smooth surface? And so we started thinking about actually mechanical buckling, because these lumps and folds, particularly the lumps and folds, made us think about how maybe the tissue is buckling due to lack of coordination of growth. So mechanical buckling is bending or giving way under weight or force. And you can see this crazy example of the train track buckling due to an earthquake. And if we look at our AS2-6D, we have these ridges and folds that we think are buckles. And then we also have additional things we call outgrowths, and we're going to distinguish those two. So we've been collaborating with Dr. Anna Maria Kiss and Reski Burud to try to model this and say, what does it need for buckling to happen in this situation? And this is from a published paper from other people. And if we think about our tissue as an unconstrained gel that swells or grows, if it's unconstrained, then it's just going to grow and we won't have any change in the buckles or the tissue. But if there's this gel bound to a surface that can't grow, and it swells, it's trying to grow, then we're going to get these buckles. And that looks a bit like what we're seeing in the sepal. Of course, the sepal is far more complicated because it's not a simple gel on a bound surface. But so Oreski and Anna Maria have done some analytical modeling, and they found that the outer epidermis should be softer than the inner epidermis, and the outer epidermis should grow more than the inner epidermis to actually get buckling. And so we wanted to test both of these predictions. So we took first tested whether the outer epidermis is actually softer than the inner epidermis. And we did this through a slightly crazy experiment where we basically say the plant cell is governed by a cell wall. So, and the cell wall is being pushed on by the internal cell. So the cell has turgor pressure on it, it's pushing on the cell wall. If we remove that turgor pressure by putting it in a bunch of salt so the water flows out, then the cell is going to shrink away from the cell wall, and then we can see how much the cell wall shrinks. If the cell wall is really stiff, it's not going to shrink at all. If the cell wall is really soft, then it's going to shrink. And so that's what we did. We took these poor flowers, put them in salt and looked at how much it shrank. And we're going to look at it in these longitudinal sections again. So here's our little tiny flower. We've taken this longitudinal section through. We've got a sepal here, a sepal here. You can see this is before treatment. This is after. You can see it shrank. Okay, so then we quantify that and look at how much it actually shrank. And so I've got a heat map here where I've colored in how much it shrank with the value of how much it shrank. So wild type, you can see the inside and the outside shrank about the same amount. And that's exactly what we predict. They shouldn't buckle and they should be the same stiffness. So they're shrinking the same amount. In the AS2-6D mutant, we can see the outside shrank a lot and the inside a lot less. And so the outside is much softer than the inside. You can see the quantification here. The outside is softer, more shrinkage is softer than the inside. And that also fits with our model. Our model is that the outside needs to be softer to get this buckling to happen because the inside's like that stiff layer we have. Okay, so check. The outer side is softer than the inside. How about the growth? And so we've actually never seen the growth on the inside of one of these sepals before. We've been doing everything just imaging the outside because it's really hard to get to the inside. So Avalanche is like, I'm going to do it. He cranked up the laser so we can get the segmentation of all the cells on the outside. He cranked up the laser, and then he goes in with the morphographics image analysis software and carefully deletes out the internal tissue of the flower so he can get at that inner epidermis. This is the first time we've ever seen that. We are so excited. We're like, oh, look at this thing. So it takes a lot of work. You can see just even from his movie that it's taking him a lot of work to get in there. And you can see we're getting out that inner surface on the exact same flower. So now we've got the inner surface. We'll get the rest of it. Okay, so you've got that inner surface and the outer surface of the same flower. And you can get the cells on the inner surface and get them all segmented, and so we can quantify their growth while we quantify the growth on the outer surface. Everyone always calls these avalaches dancing sepals. Okay, so we measured the growth on the inside and the outside. This is a growth ratio where we're dividing the later time point by the earlier time point. And so we've got a heat map here where we've got fast growth in red and slow growth in blue, and each cell is colored with this growth rate. So wild type, we have this very characteristic pattern where we have fast growth on the outer side near the top and slow growth in the middle and the base. Now, I was expecting that wild type, the inside and the outside would be the same amount of growth, right? This thing needs to be smooth, so I was like, the growth has to be coordinated. But what I was forgetting is that it starts out very, very curved. It's very curved over and actually needs to straighten up. So what we see is actually that the inside's super fast growth. So the inside is growing faster than the outside in wild type, and that's to make it straighten up a little bit.
This is based on surface or volume measurement?
This is surface. Yeah, it's a surface, it's an area. And then we looked at the AS2-6D mutant. This is, we're looking at these early stages right before it starts to have all these curvature problems. So we're looking here, and you can see that its pattern of growth is really screwed up. It doesn't have this fast growth near the tip and slow growth near the base. It's much more moderate everywhere, so moderate growth everywhere. The inside is still faster than the outside, but nowhere near as fast. And so there's definitely an imbalance in growth here. Then we looked at cell division. Again, we've got a heat map where fast division is in red, slow division in blue. You can see wild type has pretty much the same pattern, faster division near the edges, on the inside, very fast division. And in AS2, we've got fast division kind of all the way throughout. But I want to make one point, which is we don't seem to see like real fast division right here in the middle where we're going to get that first lump. I should actually go back. And see, also here, we might expect that we're going to get this lump due to real fast growth right here in the middle, and that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing growth throughout. Okay, and then fast in AS2, also faster division in the inside, but not as fast as wild type. So the cell division is kind of like the growth. It's following the growth. Then we looked at anisotropy of growth. So how much is it growing tall versus wide? And so if we have an initial cell that's square, it undergoes isotropic growth, it's going to grow the same in all directions. And we put a little cross in it to indicate same in all directions. If we have anisotropic growth, then it's going to grow taller than wide. And we are mostly going to focus on these lines here where it's growing the main orientation of growth. So if we look at wild type, you can see wild type, the outside's growing up, the inside's growing up. So that's really nice. They're very nicely coordinated. Both are growing up, right? That makes a lot of sense. If we look at the AS2, now the outside is growing at various odd angles and particularly way too wide. You can see a lot of these cells are growing in width instead of growing upward. But the inside is growing up mostly. And so there we're getting a ton of growth conflict between the inside and the outside. So the outside's growing wide, the inside's growing up, and we think that's what's really creating this growth imbalance, creating the buckling. So it's really like growing too wide while the inside's trying to grow up. Okay, so the outer epidermis is growing, well, more would be a simplified statement. It's growing more wide than the inner epidermis. And so we've got that problem. So we wanted to test this. Is this really the cause of the problem? And say, okay, you know, if the problem is that it's growing too wide, let's force those cells to grow up. And we used a genetic trick to do this. So we've got, we can overexpress KRP1 and make sepals with pretty much all giant cells, and those giant cells grow up. And we can cross that. So we've got these plant where the cells all grow up, cross it to the plant, our AS2-6D, where the cells are growing too wide and we've got all these lumps and folds. And guess what? We actually mostly rescue. So this, we were so happy when we saw this. We're like, okay, it really is the problem in the growth growing too wide. Let me show you that again here. So wild type is smooth. AS2-6D, we've got all these lumps and folds and outgrowths. And when we put in these giant cells that make it grow up, it's still a tad bit folded, but it's really, really rescued. It's much, much more smooth. And so that is telling us that it's this growth in the wrong direction. Now we just checked and made sure that we're really rescuing the growth direction. So wild type's growing up, AS2 is growing too wide. This overexpression line with too many giant cells still grows up. And when we overexpress KRP1, make too many giant cells in the AS2 mutant, it's not perfect, but it's definitely increasing the amount of upward growth, and that does seem to rescue it. So that was really cool because that was telling us that, yeah, it is this change in growth pattern of the outer surface that's the problem. Okay, so the outer abaxial epidermis is too soft compared to the inner side, and it's growing too wide, and that's causing, we think, mechanical buckling. So we know that we need to have proper coordination of growth to get this smooth sepal epidermis. We've got, we need to have AS2 only on the inside. When AS2 is on the outside, growth is uncoordinated, it grows too wide and makes this complex shape. So the outer side of the AS2 grows too wide compared to the inside. We also have this thing that I've been telling you is outgrowths. And so we have what we've been calling buckles, but we also have outgrowths here. And I want to very quickly address outgrowths because one of the questions, one of the themes I've been seeing through these talks is the question of can mechanics actually feed back and influence then the genes and the gene expression and the signaling? And that's what you're going to see here really briefly. So these outgrowths, I've been telling you the buckles form just by overgrowth in general of the sepal surface. The outgrowths form by too much growth and division at certain localized points. And so they're distinct from the buckles. They really are growing too much right here to make these little pointed structures. Okay, so our hypothesis, and I'm sorry I'm going to get a little planty on you, but we'll try to abstract it, is that the mechanical buckling is actually causing the reorientation of auxin flow. Auxin's a plant hormone, so we're going to change the signaling pattern to create an auxin peak that's actually going to cause these outgrowths. So mechanical stress is known to be able to alter the polarity of the auxin efflux transporter pin in a cell. And so pin moves auxin out of the cell, and the pin makes the whole flow of auxin around the plant, and auxin does everything in plant development. So pin is going to pump auxin and make a new maximum, like a new concentration of auxin, as it does in the meristem when it makes a new primordium. And then auxin, the auxin maxima is going to cause these outgrowths to happen. So if you look right here, we've got our AS2 flowers, and we've got outgrowths. And you can see, so here's the tissue with the cell walls. Here's pin 1 with GFP. You can see these outgrowths here, they also have pin 1. But the buccals do not. So buccals don't have pin 1 generally, but when the buccals causes convergence points to make pin 1 to concentrate auxin. So we asked, is auxin transport required for the formation of these outgrowths? And we use a chemical inhibitor called NPA to inhibit the auxin transport. It's not completely gone, so it's down. And what we're looking at is the AS2 mutant treated with MOC or treated with the NPA. So the MOC is on the top, and you can see we start out smooth, and then we start getting this buckling happening, and then we start getting outgrowths after the buckling, and you can see it gets more and more complex shape with outgrowths and buckles. Here, when it's treated with NPA, you can see that it's very smooth, and then it starts buckling, but the outgrowths are really suppressed, particularly on this front sepal. You can see you're not getting these crazy outgrowths. It's definitely buckling, but not making outgrowths. And I thought this was just awesome because we're separating the two processes. We can get, we could still get the mechanical buckling because the overall growth is altered, but we're not getting that concentration of auxin signaling caused by the mechanical buckling to initiate these outgrowths that shouldn't be there. Okay, so what we see is that the outer or abaxial side of VOS3 is growing too wide, causing buckling, and then the buckles cause the formation of outgrowths influencing polar auxin transport. And I just want to reflect for a second here that buckling is actually a very key mechanism in generating shape. And a lot of times the organism is orchestrating buckling to happen, right? It's trying to make buckles. So here's some examples of various petals where different forms of buckling create the really complex shapes. So you can have twisting, helical twisting, saddle bending, and edge waving on these different types of petals. But in my case, so in this case, the plant is orchestrating buckling, presumably through altering growth. This is true also in animals. So the folds in the cerebral cortex of the brain are due to buckling. Some of the looping of the gut is due to buckling. You guys probably know this better than I do. But what we've shown is that the plant doesn't always want buckling to happen. So it's very carefully orchestrating its growth and coordinating growth across the organ somehow. And that's the big question, is how is it doing this to make sure that buckling doesn't happen? And so that it can make flat structures like leaves and sepals. Okay, I'd like to conclude by thanking the people who did the work. So most of the work I've been telling you about was done by my postdoc, Avalash Singh Yadav. This is a great collaboration with Arezki Burud and Anna Maria Kiss. And obviously, we've been using a ton of morphographics, which is a collaboration with Richard Smith. And this has been funded by the NIH. Thanks, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.